The Guardian. Hello, and welcome back to the MP3 We Call Tech Weekly. I'm Jemima Kish, and on this week's show...
When Andy Haldane, who's what, number two at the Bank of England, when he stands up and says peer-to-peer lending will in time replace high street banks, what he's referring to is not that it's just $2 billion that have been lent. He's looking at the dynamics, and he's saying to traditional sectors, you've got to figure out how you maintain relevance, not within the next 2 years, but within the next 10 years.
Rachel Botsman coined the term collaborative consumption and predicted the growth of services and sites like Airbnb and One Fine Stay. Alex Kratosky met up with Rachel at the Sydney Book Fair to discuss the growing acceptance of this tech-based business model. And...
I want to be able to allow people to be present in every moment, just interact with people in a normal way, and then afterwards decide, okay, photos from here, are they worth sharing or not with other people?
With Google Glass hype abounding... On a recent trip to Sweden, I met the people behind another wearable technology, a way to document your life in digital images. It's a piece of tech called Momoto, and I'll be talking to its inventor and founder, Martin Kallstrom. Of course, we'll have a tech news roundup, and this week, we hear why Facebook backed down from a media and tech-savvy campaign to fight misogyny and violence against women on the social network, and why a new report says illegal downloads are on the rise. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Tech Weekly's Alex Kratosky is in fine globe-trotting form at the moment. She popped over from the US to the Sydney Book Fair in Australia, where she met the woman who, in 2009, defined a new trend in tech and online entrepreneurship with her book, Collaborative Consumption. Alex met up with social innovator Rachel Botsman to find out more.
So I'm at the Sydney Writers Festival still, and I'm speaking with Rachel Botsman, who wrote a book on collaborative consumption. In fact, Rachel, it's the kind of Bible on collaborative consumption, isn't it?
I guess you could call it that. It's actually a book that I wrote 3 years ago now, but the idea has really taken off in the last 18 months. There's businesses that are now reaching scale, and people are, I think, now getting what I meant, so...
Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot on Tech Weekly is we have touched on several of the collaborative consumption ideas. Most recently, Jemima Kish. Jemima wrote about or talked with the people behind One Fine Stay.
Yeah.
Now, One Fine Stay is interesting because they distinguish themselves from Airbnb, yeah, which is the kind of poster child at the moment for the collaborative consumption. And they distinguish themselves because they talk about a technology that they built. In some ways, it feels as if they don't have faith in the concept behind collaborative consumption because they feel that they need to have a technology that goes with it. What do you think of that?
One Fine Stay is a very sort of upmarket audience. So it's properties over £1 million. It's people that wouldn't necessarily rent out their place on Airbnb. So when you talk to the... founders of One Fine Stay, what I found is the technology is really the matching platform for them, but they put equal service, they put equal weight on the service that One Fine Stay offers. So whereas a lot of other examples, those companies are really enabled by the technology and the technology enables the magic to happen, One Fine Stay is slightly different in that respect.
Are there other collaborative consumption properties, other services, you know, whether we're talking about things like Zipcar, for example, which is kind of a collaborative consumption, or TaskRabbit, or any of these other poster children for collaborative consumption. Are there any others that are like One Fine Stay developing technologies, or are they using the systems that already exist?
No, I mean, what you see in a lot of these companies is there's as much value in the technologies they're creating as the marketplaces themselves. So you actually discover that TaskRabbit has a white label product behind their platform because they've basically developed a real-time marketplace to match on-demand needs, which is incredibly valuable beyond the context of errands. If you look at some of the peer-to-peer car sharing services, like Relay Rides just acquired Wheels, it's because the keyless system, the tracking system, the technology they've built to make the sharing frictionless is more valuable than the Wheels company itself. So I think what you're going to start to see happen is the tools and the technologies, the payment systems these companies are creating. Airbnb just created a verification of identity system that is superior to what the government has in terms of being able to verify your real world identity is the same as your online identity. I think you will see these companies selling those products to non-collaborative consumption marketplaces.
Is that how they will survive?
No, I think there's many that are and will be successful in their own right. So they're already becoming billion-dollar marketplaces. There's going to be a lot more aggregation and consolidation of the market. I think what you'll see is some of the smaller players that have an interesting technology, they will sell it or partner with a bigger player versus trying to go into the same vertical.
So why do you think it has been in the last 18 months that you know, people have been talking about this, that we've seen, you know, we've seen people on the cover, people in this market on the cover of Fortune, that we've seen headlines across places like The Economist, you've seen, you know, the Guardian covers it quite a lot.
I think it's a case of it reaching enough scale in enough different verticals for people to realize this isn't a trend. So peer-to-peer lending is a really good one. So Zopa in the UK, you know, when Andy Haldane, who's what, number two at the Bank of England, when he stands up and says peer-to-peer lending will in time replace high street banks, what he's referring to is not that it's just $2 billion that have been lent. He's looking at the dynamics and he's saying to traditional sectors, you've got to figure out how you maintain relevance, not within the next 2 years, but within the next 10 years. So I think you're seeing a shift from business that's actually realizing this is a big innovation opportunity for them, but you're also seeing a big shift in user behavior where the trust piece, which is so key to these things, it's becoming just more familiar. And I don't know if it's just because more people are doing it, that these services are actually trustworthy and they do actually work.
It's interesting though, especially with something like peer-to-peer lending, that the technology, which is the thing that most people who don't use the web or who are concerned about the web, is actually the mechanic that is making the system work, that it is actually the trust system. Because if I gave you a fiver, even though, you know, we've met, we've had conversations, you know, etc., I don't know if you're going to give me that fiver back. It could potentially be the ruin of our friendship if you don't give me the fiver back. But now that we've got an independent third party, also known as the internet or the computer, is that the function of these systems?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. So in just taking the lending example, it's interesting because you never lend direct. Your loan gets hedged 10 ways, so it's not one loan. And the technology makes that process frictionless, so as the lender, you're not actually picking. But what I think is so interesting is that the default rate is so low. So I think it's like under 0.5% now on Zopa, whereas if you look at traditional banking, it's around 3-4, and credit cards is 8%. Now, what's happening there is technology is actually making us more accountable to one another. So you're actually saying, I trust a stranger, I feel more accountable to a stranger than I do to a big bank. So I find it really interesting when you look at all the ways banks are using technology to make sort of the banking experience more seamless. It doesn't actually change our financial behaviors, but the way these platforms are using it is changing the way we pay back loans.
So I believe it was Budget Rent-A-Car that just acquired Zipcar. Oh, it was Avis that acquired Zipcar, which is the car sharing system that I'm most familiar with. You also mentioned Wheels was acquired as well, but that was consolidation within the collaborative consumption market. Why? Why are they, other than they view it as a threat? And also, how will this affect consumer behavior? If, you know, if people see that Avis is doing this and they trust Avis as a brand, does that mean more people are going to use it? How do you see the acquisition by traditional organizations in this market changing the collaborative consumption market?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk as to whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. As to why Avis did it, you hear this a lot with traditional players that want to enter this segment, is it's easier for them to acquire than it is for them to innovate themselves. Just because their culture is so entrenched in either selling cars or traditional hire that to actually get into this mindset and change their culture is extremely difficult. When these types of acquisitions, I don't have a problem with these types of acquisitions. I mean, Google just took a $150 million investment in Lending Club. They're a very powerful signal to the rest of the market that you have to pay attention, that this isn't just a startup community. I think they are scared of the disruption, but the reason why, you know, I sort of take the counter view that this isn't a bad thing is that we actually have to get the mainstream brands on board, because that's how we create the mainstream change in behavior. So to really get beyond the early adopter market, you need companies like Ford and Peugeot and Volkswagen saying, you know, in the future, our focus won't be on selling cars, it will be on mobility services. And this is how you should choose these options, not because it's the better thing to do or the right thing to do, but actually because it's a better option for you as the consumer. You're going to get more convenience and choice than owning a car.
Finally, it's been 3 years since you wrote the book, and I know you're about to go into seclusion for the next, I don't know if it's the next iteration of this kind of thing, but I'm curious, it's been 3 years, you've done a lot of speaking, you've done a TED Talk, you've talked to a lot of people about this. What would you say has been the things that have really transformed in the last 3 years that in this market that you feel are particularly notable?
It's a great question. If I had to sort of pinpoint three big areas of transformation, one is that sort of the regulating industries around this space kind of ignored it, and that was actually a good thing. So whether that was the policies that are happening, you know, there's all kinds of issues now in New York where they're actually closing down a lot of these services. So in terms of sort of the legalities and how in many instances these companies are creating a market for things that never had a marketplace before, so they don't follow traditional policy, is a real problem. So that's a big area where it's getting attention, and we need to work hard to solve that. The second I would say is, you know, the investment community. I've known these entrepreneurs since they were the cliche working in their bedrooms, and to hear, you know, yesterday Lyft, which is an on-demand ride-sharing service, these guys have been working on it for 6 years. Yesterday they got $60 million. So this is a shitload of serious amount of money. It's not hard for them if they have a great idea, where it was really tough pitching. And then I think the third thing is just the creativity around some of the ideas that I think even a few years ago would have seemed a little bit wild and wouldn't have worked, like dog vacay, where pet owners can find people who love dogs to leave their pooches with when they go on holiday rather than leaving them in kennels. That's a $10 billion sector that they're disrupting. Those kind of wonderful innovations are starting to appear that are sort of they're not in discrete verticals, but are examples of collaborative consumption.
Interesting, and also interesting between the notion of the local versus the notion of the global and all of that. So I look forward to seeing what it is that you come up with when you're in your period of purda. So thank you very much, Rachel, at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
And thanks to Rachel Botsman and to Alex. It goes without saying that Rachel, like all good social innovators, bagged herself a .com. So to find out more, just go to rachelbotsman.com. And now for this week's Technology News Roundup with Jason Phipps.
This week, in the aftermath of the Woolwich attacks in London, experts have urged caution in the face of pressure on internet companies to remove extremist websites, and calls by MPs and others for a clampdown on the dissemination of online jihadist rhetoric. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, said she wanted to see what more could be done to police online messages preaching violence or jihad, adding, quote, "One of the issues we need to look at is whether we have got the right processes, the right rules in place in relation to what is being beamed into people's homes," she said. However, Tim Stevens, co-author of a major piece of research in 2009 into countering online radicalisation, warned that little had changed since the report, which concluded that any strategy that relied on reducing the availability of online content alone was bound to be crude, expensive, and counterproductive. He added, "My feeling is that the police have got better things to do, and so do the intelligence services, who already have the tools and powers to see who is seeing material, downloading it, and putting it up." Also this week, we learnt that Facebook has bowed to an outcry over content promoting violence against women after advertisers pulled ads in protest. The climb down followed a week-long campaign by Women, Action and the Media, the Everyday Sexism Project, and the activist Soria Chemalu to remove supposedly humorous content endorsing rape and domestic violence. The company said it would update its policies on hate speech, increase accountability of content creators, and train staff to be more responsive to complaints, marking a victory for women's rights activists. Facebook said, "We need to do better, and we will." Facebook initially rebuffed the complaints, citing freedom of speech. A spokesman for Facebook told Huffington Post UK, quote, "As you may expect, in any diverse community of more than a billion people, we occasionally see people post distasteful or disturbing content or make crude attempts at humour. While it may be vulgar and offensive, distasteful content on its own does not violate our policies." The campaigning group Women, Action and the Media said that at least 15 companies had pulled their ads from Facebook, including Nissan UK, Nationwide UK, J Street and Westhost. In a survey by the UK regulator Ofcom, it was revealed that almost a third of UK internet users who stream or download music, TV and films did so at least once illegally. Ofcom's latest online copyright infringement tracker report found that digital piracy of music, film, TV, books, video games and computer software rose in the 3 months to the end of January 2013 compared with the previous quarter. The report, financially supported by the Intellectual Property Office, found that almost 1 in 6, that's 18%, of internet users aged 12 and over access digital entertainment media using an illegal service. Music is by far the most popular digital media pirated, accounting for 280 million of the 386 million items of content illegally accessed over those 3 months. The report said that the most common reason given for accessing illegal content are because it is, quote, free, convenient, and quick. And finally, video of the week on The Guardian's technology site has to be the Institute of Advanced Architecture of Catalonia's new anti-gravity 3D printer. Yes, I said it, anti-gravity 3D printer. The latest twist in the 3D printing technology is a robotic arm that can squirt an air-drying thick liquid into complex architectural forms. To see the video of this amazing bit of technology, just click on the link on the Tech Weekly blog. You won't regret it. For all these stories in text and video form, just go to the best tech news site on the web. That's guardian.co.uk/tech.
Sometimes the best moments in life are the simple ones. The things that pass us by without us even noticing. The small surprises. And the everyday experiences. At Momodo, we love the simple moments, but we hate forgetting them.
Now, on a recent visit to Sweden to take a look at the technology scene, I came across a natty bit of technology called Momodo. It's a square inch of camera that clips to your lapel and takes two photos a minute, the ultimate life blogging tool, so no privacy issues there then. I spoke to the inventor, Martin Kallstrom.
Martin, the obvious thing that people are going to think of straight away is Google Glass. So, you know, there are big, very, very of-the-moment questions about how much we need this monitoring in every moment of our lives.
Yeah, of course. And that's something something that we really hear a lot. And for me, it's really not about capturing every moment, but to get some idea of what you did during the day and be able to stay present in every moment without having to think about how I'm going to publish this on Facebook later, or I need to remember to Instagram this moment because I'm having a good time. I want to be able to allow people to be present in every moment, just interact with people in a normal way, and then afterwards decide, is this okay, photos from here, are they worth sharing or not with other people?
2,000 photos is a lot of pictures in one day. Isn't this sort of building up a lot of extra data? It's like a data burden for people.
Not at all, actually. What we do is that we only show you the photos that our algorithm has decided is the most important during the day. And then all the rest are available, but you don't have to think about them. You can just look up the photos from the moments that you want to remember. And the rest is just stowed away without you having to think about them. And that's much of how we relate to all the data on our laptops. We have gigabytes of documents that we never care about. We only search and find those that we care about. And it's the exact same thing with the photos from Emoto.
Is it possible that further down the line people might be able to prioritize the interestingness of their photos? So it wouldn't just be done by quality, it would be done by, I don't know, whether a particular person was in them. What are you looking at in that area?
Yeah, so what's so fantastic about capturing full photos instead of just sort of accelerometer data like other devices do is that you can go back afterwards and do analysis on the photos and discover so much about your life that you didn't know beforehand. And that could be, we can do statistics on if how much you spend indoors and outdoors, how much you spend time in the city or in green areas like a park or something like that, what people you meet and so on. And we don't have to decide that beforehand. We can do that analysis afterwards as software progresses and as people build stuff on top of our API. And your photos are yours. You can use them to whatever means you like. And with Memoto, that's your private journal. It's not something that will be open for everybody, so you decide.
Where can we get one of these delicious-looking lapel cameras? When are they coming to market?
You can check them out at Memoto.com. They will start shipping a few months from now, but you can pre-order them already to get in line. And the first people that pre-order will get a preview sometime during the summer in the coming months. And there's lots of info and videos on Memoto.com as well.
And how much would we be forking out for one of these?
Yeah, so one camera is $279 in euros. I suppose that's $250 or something. I'm not sure, but $279 US anyway.
Thank you very much. We'll be on a lapel near you soon.
And for all the latest on that, you can see more at Memoto.com. That's all for this week. Thank you for downloading us legally. But from me, Jemima Kish, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, catch you all next week. Adieu.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.